Eye on Careers, in association with Laymoon.com. Refresh your career with jobs, courses, and events.
Welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And this is the show designed to give you an edge in your career, give you an edge in your professional career, and help you get that next rung in the ladder. We have looked at some of the biggest success stories of this city, and I want to just thank everybody for supporting this show. And to all the CEOs, entrepreneurs, and businessmen, millionaires, and some, we had one or two billionaires even come on the show. And share their secrets to success. We just had the story of Aaron's very own Steve Smith, the chief operating officer, a man who is going to be a professional Australian football player, and changed his mind due to an injury and went into the media business and has been a huge success, working his way from the bottom all the way to the top. We had some key success tenets of the success story. There was direction, focus, doing your research, understand who the players are, who the competitors are, and be persistent. He got his first job in the media after applying for 3 months to the same 20-30 companies over and over, to when he called, they knew him by first name basis. How many of you are that persistent with your career? Do your research. That was his final, you know, that was his final advice, was do your research, set your goals. And I loved one of his great takeaways was, you know, write those goals on your bathroom mirror. I never even thought of that. Usually, you know, you put a clipboard up or you make a goal board, but you have to look at that every morning. Just by writing a goal down, you become 40% more likely to achieve that goal. 40%. So how hard is that? But, you know, 80% of people don't take that step and write your goals down. So that first step is just sitting there waiting for you. Dubai is full of opportunities. We're in the middle of the world, and we're on the precipice of some of the greatest moments in history. I personally believe, in my humble opinion, in terms of what's going to happen economically as we walk through the 21st century. And one of those sectors that's undeniably exciting and fast growing in the Middle East, North African region is the healthcare business. I personally am not in the healthcare business, but I have read stats that I think they're trying to double the number of hospitals in the next 5 or 10 years. Crazy numbers. And I think, you know, you've seen some of our neighboring countries investing as a percentage of their GDP, the highest investment in the world in terms of the investment that's going into healthcare in the region. And you can also see a trail of private equity firms chasing this trend. Lots of FDI coming into the region, and a lot of action going on here. But we have David Hadley, the Chief Executive Officer of MediClinic Middle East. MediClinic is a subsidiary of MediClinic International, which is ranked in the top 10 private hospital groups in the world by market capitalization. But what I love about this story is he started his career as a filing clerk and worked his way up, you know. And again, when we look at the success stories, we just had Steve on, we've had so many other entrepreneurs on, we're now looking at David's story. The focus, the direction, the hunger to stay in your industry and develop yourself within that. You know, there are people who may be outliers who jump across industries and still make it to the top. But statistically, you know, when you look at the highest paid people in the world for their professions, they've generally been, you know, in that same role for a long time. So this is the story of David Hadley. David, I'd love to invite you to Eye on Careers. Welcome, and thank you for coming out.
Thank you very much, Shane, and welcome, listeners, and thank you for having me here this evening.
I was so excited. I just kept talking about your intro, and I almost forgot to intro to the show, but it's just such an exciting field that you're in. You know, the healthcare field in the Middle East has got to be, you know, one of the most exciting regions. I mean, you as a healthcare professional, could there be a more exciting geography to be in healthcare than the Middle East?
I don't think so. I think if you look at the Middle East, and specifically in Dubai, the way the country's growing, the way it's evolving, it's obviously going to age. It's a very young profiled population, and as it gets older, it's going to need more healthcare. It's a nascent society, and there's going to be new regulations, mandatory health insurance recently announced, and lots of new exciting developments within the region, and lots of opportunities for us in healthcare.
So, David, the healthcare business is booming, but you started. You know, you're not an opportunist. This has been a long, a lifetime journey for you. You started as a filing clerk. Do you ever just walk in the office and say, "Who did this filing? Who's been doing this filing? This is all wrong." Is that, or like the guy who runs the Hilton says he can tell that there's something wrong when there aren't cookies on the pillow, the little details.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell the quality of healthcare by the files or?
Probably not anymore. It's changed a lot. But I think working your way up through the ladder and working your way through various departments, certainly you do spot the smaller things. Like your example of the Hilton, you definitely do notice the smaller things if you've been in the lower positions, for sure.
I think, when you look at business, right, everybody can go and spot the upside. So, I could go get my MBA, do an analysis and say, oh, well, we look at the growth in Saudi Arabia and your net profit or your internal, your IRR, your net present value of this investment over 10 years will be X. But it takes a real professional to understand the risks, and that's where you lose, right? That's where your competitors take you out.
Yeah.
And I don't know. By staying in an industry, I feel that those executives have gotten to the top because they understand the inherent risk, the idiosyncratic risk to that business. And I don't know if you agree or disagree.
Yeah, for sure. I think it comes. I mean, experience comes with experience. There's only one way to get it, and that's through doing the same thing over and over and over. And if you've been in the industry longer and you understand the industry well, you get to understand where the thing's going, where things are moving to, you learn lessons from the past and you're able to obviously change things for the future. So I think it's very important if you're in the same industry for a long time that you. I think it's very good if you're in the same industry for a long time that you're able to use that experience to the better of the company going forward, for sure.
But how do you continually move up? Because, lots of people get stuck. There's always those people who aren't being promoted and hate anybody who is going to get promoted,
yeah.
And they want to stop that. And then there's just some people who wake up and they just, I worked with one guy literally, and he was so miserable in his life that when he saw happy people, that he actually got angry and he would try to destroy their happiness. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy people in the world, right? So you have to navigate this game of snakes and ladders.
Yeah.
How do you continually move up starting from a filing clerk?
I think when I look back, it wasn't, I never thought that I would reach these heights when I was a filing clerk. I was just looking at the next step at that stage. And I think perhaps that's important, is you first look at the next step and you focus on that. I learned a very valuable lesson, or a very good saying, should I say, from a mentor, one of the mentors that I worked with over the years. And he had a good saying where he said, it's getting promoted or getting a new opportunity or a new job is a bit like surfing. If you're out there in the waves and you're sitting on your surfboard and you've got the little doofer wrapped around your ankle and you're paddling away and this huge wave comes and comes over your board, then you're going to miss it. But if you're standing on your board and you're balanced, and you're waiting for the wave, when that wave hits, you ride it. It's not luck. It's because you were ready for it. You were waiting for it. So you've actually got to be ready for these opportunities as they come along. And as I progressed, I think I perhaps was applying for positions and trying to move up when I wasn't yet standing on the board. I was probably, lying on my tummy, busy rolling, paddling out to sea. And I think that was a very good analogy of the way to prepare yourself to go forward, is be standing on your board, be balanced, be ready, so that when that wave hits you, you're ready to ride it.
So you don't believe in luck. I heard one person describe to me, he said, Shane, luck is where skill and opportunity meet. And I don't know, do you believe in luck? Does luck play a role, or you're saying it doesn't?
It depends what your definition of luck is. I seem to have a hell of a lot of bad luck on the golf course, and I play with people who seem to have a hell of a lot of good luck. And I think it's what you know, the way you define luck. I mean, golf is another good analogy of life. And I think it was Jack Nicklaus who once said, you know, the caddy for Jack Nicklaus once said, he said, you know, when he played with Jack Nicklaus, the difference between him and other golfers was when he had a perfect drive right down the middle, and the drive was stuck in a divot, you know, in a little hole in the middle of the fairway. So it wasn't a good lie. For those who don't play golf, it's not easy to hit it out of a divot. He would walk up to that ball and he'd say, watch this shot. Watch me hit this shot out of this lie. Whereas other people would say, oh, look at my luck. Look how bad luck. Look at this. And they'd beat themselves up over it, and then they'd get stuck in that divot and they wouldn't get out. So I think it depends on what the definition of luck is, because there's various understandings of what luck is, and it's how you see it. Is that bad luck that he was in the divot, or good luck because he believes he's so good at getting out of it?
And you mentioned mentorship, that you had a mentor. Did you actively seek out a mentor early career, or how should someone approach mentorship as they develop themselves?
You know, we're in a world today, especially with the digital age, with internet and you know, the way we have access to so many different people and their thoughts, that we're surrounded by mentors. If I look back at myself, my mom was a mentor for me, my granddad was a mentor for me, and then as I got into the business world, my very first boss was a mentor for me. And then when I moved on in my career, I realized that the first boss probably wasn't that good. But, you know, you have mentors all around you, and it's what you take from them and create, you know, or what you take from them to develop yourself. You get good managers, bad managers, and all of them are actually mentors to you. Because even the bad managers, you learn from them what not to do. And they're pretty good. They're probably sometimes the better mentors.
So it's almost good early career to go and work for companies that are completely on fire and going belly up, so you realize what not to do.
Yeah, it could help you. Yeah, definitely.
Were you a big sportsman growing up? I'm getting a
definitely.
Read here that you know there's a big sports theme going on. We had, you know, our first guest was inches away from becoming professional.
Yeah.
What was your sporting experience like?
I did a lot of sports. I also went over to the UK and played rugby, and also got a few injuries. And
professionally, you played rugby?
No, I didn't play professionally, but I played for a professional team, and I was in the second team, so I didn't have a professional scholarship.
So one step away from being pro.
Yeah,
that's the theme tonight, I think. Yeah. I don't know what's going
on. I took reflection on myself in practice one session when a guy that was coming towards the end of his career, it was rugby, was coming towards the end of his career, and we were playing touch rugby, and I actually couldn't touch him.
You can't tell this whole story right now. this is a story of David Hadley, Chief Executive Officer of MediClinic. He's about to share one of his epic sports stories with us, so just stay with us for 1 minute, and we'll be right back. Hello, and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are looking at the story of David Hadley, the Chief Executive Officer of MediClinic. David, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
And so we were just talking a little bit about your career and how you actually started out as a sportsman as well, uncanny similarity to our first guest, and that you almost played professional rugby in the UK.
Yeah, but pretty much by luck. I didn't have a plan to be a professional rugby player, but I ended up playing for a good team and had these ambitions to be this great player and get paid and make lots of money and all the superstardom that comes with it. But I quickly realized during one of the practice sessions that I probably was never going to be good at it. We had a touch rugby session where you just have to touch the guy and then he drops the ball and the next guy comes in. And there was a guy coming towards the end of his career, and he was no further than a meter away from me, and I physically couldn't touch him. He was so quick. And then I realized I'm too slow for the sport, and decided to pack it all in and go back to MediClinic.
Not before you lost a couple of teeth and a few scars over your eye, and you got to rack up the injuries, right?
Yeah, definitely.
The sacrifice. What is it that, you know, really separates someone who makes it or who doesn't make it or makes a successful, when you talk about the parallels between sports and business? Mm. What do you see as some of those stronger themes?
I think it's the power of the mind. And I mean, I don't want to sound like a psychologist, but if you think of Tiger Woods a couple of years ago as a golfer, I mean,
that's a dangerous example.
It's probably
I don't know what people,
example,
whatever's going through people's mind. You may have been off point there, but okay.
But if you look at Tiger, I mean, there was a time when he was invincible. It didn't matter who he played against. You just couldn't beat him. And obviously he had a few mishaps. And since then, everybody thinks they can beat him. So, I mean, and his game is the same. He hits the ball as straight and as far, and he's still as good at putting, and he's actually still a number one golfer in the world. But how on earth does he not win any more majors? How has he not won a major for so many years? It's all in the mind. And I think in business, that differentiates the people that make it to the top and those that that perhaps just have the skills.
And I think so many people don't realize this, but, you know, he who thinks he can and he who thinks he can't are both right.
Yeah, probably will, yeah.
And I can't remember who said that, but it was, yeah. I think it might have been Socrates or someone famous that knew lots of stuff. But, you know, it's really comes down to that. And oftentimes when you see people who are dropping the ball, oh, I feel like they're making excuses, because it's tough to say, hey, I didn't achieve that because I don't believe in myself.
Exactly, yeah.
That's the toughest thing. And at the end of the day, you know, when we looked at Steve was just on and he was talking about be honest with yourself and get, you know, almost what I say, get naked with yourself. Do you have to do that? Do you have to be that transparent and bare, you know, if you're really going to push yourself to the ultimate limit?
Absolutely. You need to. I mean, Jim Collins wrote a very good book called Good to Great, and I would strongly recommend reading it if you're an aspiring businessman. And he writes there, face the brutal facts. And that's a true. There's nothing more true than that. I mean, if you don't face the brutal facts about yourself, you will never improve and you will never take steps forward.
Unfortunately, most of the companies in Jim's book are got slammed, but it is probably one of the most prolific leadership book that's been written so far. And it's probably best-selling all over the world.
Yeah.
He does say that get to the brutal honesty and that self-awareness is so important. But if you don't believe in yourself, how do you get to that point? I mean, did you always just have this a wavering faith in yourself, or you have to develop that over time?
I think there's times where you doubt, there's always times where you doubt yourself and you doubt your abilities. I think experience gives you more confidence in yourself, for sure. Studying, going to school and studying an MBA or studying a degree or studying a profession, practicing that profession will definitely give you more confidence in whatever you're doing. They say public speaking, if you want to be good at public speaking, just speak more publicly. And so those sort of examples give you more faith in yourself. But there's no question, I don't think anybody can honestly say that they are not nervous when they take on something new or they take on a different task.
Right, so I guess what you're talking about there is courage as well. You know, what's a subtext? And I have a theory about that, you know, that you may say, okay, just some people are naturally courageous. But when you look at people who've had who are hugely courageous, I don't think it stems from them being innately courageous. I think it stems from the fact that their values are so strong that they're willing to die for what they believe in.
Yeah.
And that will overcome any form of cowardice, because I think there's cowardice in everybody, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think I had Rick Pudner here, who is the former one of the CEOs from HSBC, and he said, you know, when I joined Emirates NBD, of course you're nervous about going from an international to a local, and so many, anyone who says they're not nervous when they first day on the job is a liar. And, you know, but you have to overcome that. And I think that's really critical. Where does your value systems character play into that? And have you had experiences as you developed those? You know, have you had any major milestones as you developed that character?
I don't think there's been a single job that I haven't been nervous about taking on. Every single one of the positions that I've taken on, I've been nervous the first day on the job. I think in terms of values, I've never wavered from my values. I've always stuck to them, even if it cost us money or cost the business money. I mean, I'm a very ethical person, and sometimes in business or in life, you get offered unethical opportunities, and I've been very true to myself in that. I stick to the values that I believe in. So I think the points you make there, I've probably experienced many of them over the years. But I think being nervous is natural. And if you're not nervous, it probably means you're not caring about it, or you're not really interested in it. If you're nervous about it, it means it's important to you.
What's the most nervous you've been, or the most scared you've ever been? You know, we had Rajaram, who's the CEO of Al Nabuta Automobiles, on here, and he said, you know, I had, I can't remember how many R8s, you know, these cars are crazy expensive, like almost $1 billion or a billion dirhams of stock. And in the middle of the financial crisis, he says, you know, if that doesn't make your heart flutter, you know, I don't know what does. Of course, he got through it with flying colors. He's kind of the star of the automobile industry. Yeah. So it's a safe example to use. But, you know, have you ever woken up and been nervous? Or what you know, I like to use the captain of the New Orleans police, you know, when the thing was underwater and people were looting and people were beating and he had to do a press conference, you know, like have fun putting that uniform on that morning. Did you ever have any days like that where you're like, I don't know how I'm going to pull through this?
Many days. In the business world, many times. I can't think which one I was the most nervous. You mentioned the words, when were you the most nervous? It was when I bungee jumped off the Vic Falls.
Oh, come on.
That was without a doubt the most nervous I've ever been. But in the business, I think there's been many a time where I've been extremely nervous. You know, things are not going the way you planned. The business is not performing the way you anticipated. Your strategy that you had, you know, is not working. There's been many a time that that's happened. And, yeah, you overcome it.
What was the worst one where you're like, wow, why did I do this to myself? I should have just stayed a filing clerk. Less headache, right?
Yeah, definitely. I can't think of one now, but I think
you have to come back. We'll have to come back to that. So, I mean, but I think, you know, so many people think that once you're the CEO, that things are much more rosy and, you know, that it's easier and it's lighter. And I haven't dealt with a single CEO who's sitting there going, oh, wow, this is just so great. Such a great job. I have, you know, no problems. The pressure is immense. The problems are often unsolvable. There's no clear solution. And any wrong step, you could be facing impending doom for the entire organization. You know, is it that stressful, or am I dramatizing the role?
No, I think it is stressful. I've learned that no matter what position you're in, even if you're a filing clerk or you're an HR clerk or you've got stress. And I think as you get promoted or as you grow up, as you evolve in the corporate ladder, you get promoted, you start to look back on those situations and you realize, you know, that now is not stressful for me. I can overcome that because I've outgrown that. I've got experience. I understand it. And perhaps when you are the leader of a company and you're pioneering new grounds, there's new stressors that come into play. And therefore, you need to overcome those. And, you know, but they're big. They seem to be bigger than what they were when you're in a lesser position, for sure.
I think when you look at healthcare or our first guest, when you look at media, you know, there's that opportunity to help people or make a difference in the community. And that gives you a sense of purpose. That can also fuel your fire. That can give you the drive. You know, is a sense of purpose, the fact that you are making, you know, you're an integral part of a positive community experience, is that part of the drive? And is a sense of purpose really integral to a success story?
I think so. I think definitely so. If you look at healthcare, we're in the private healthcare industry. So there's two situations here. The first one is we make people better. And I think the reason why the healthcare industry is booming around the world is because people live longer. And that is because of the way healthcare has evolved. We're aging. People are living a lot longer, so therefore they need more healthcare. The improvements of healthcare are astronomical. So it's great to be part of that. Being in private healthcare, people feel it should be free. And that also comes with its challenges. You know, people don't want to pay for healthcare. They all want it, but nobody wants to pay for it. So it has its challenges as well in terms of offering something that people believe should be a born right. I mean, we pay for food, you know, which most people need, but healthcare we believe should be for free. And I think that comes with its challenges, but it is good to see how you can make a difference in terms of people's lives. And it's so evident around the world today how people are living longer, how healthcare is improving the way we live.
I think in the 1800s, the living expectancy was 37, and I think now it's like 85 or 87 or something like that. Yeah. And I think that's going to go up. They said potentially, if you're born right now, that you could live to 200.
Yeah, I've read similar articles where they say the man who's going to live to 150 has already been born. So I think it's if you look at the way the age, the mortalities are increasing. You know, the age of people is increasing. It's astronomical. I have a theory. I don't understand why people can retire at 60 anymore. because they're not going to die at 65. They're going to live till they're 80-odd, so they might as well carry on working for a while. That'll probably solve all of Europe's problems.
I wish I could retire right now, but this is the story of David Hadley, Chief Executive Officer of MediClinic. They are one of the top 10 private healthcare providers in the world. He started as a filing clerk, worked his way up to the corner office. He's sharing his secrets to success, so stay with us. Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and this is the show where we look at helping you become more successful. We just heard the story of Steve Smith, the Chief Operating Officer of the Arabian Radio Network, the region's largest radio network with 3.2 million listeners, and you are one of those listeners right now if you're listening to this. And, you know, we have another CEO in the house right now from MediClinic, which is one of the top 10 private healthcare providers in the world. And, you know, I think, you know, when you look at people who are performing at that level where they're actually competing in the world, there's lots of tidbits, or as my friend Jack Montgomery likes to say, golden nuggets that you can take out with you. And we also have a free event on January 14th, Tuesday, January 14th at the Canadian University of Dubai. Colm McLaughlin, the Executive Vice Chairman of Dubai Duty Free, is going to be talking about how he started in 1983 and turned an old used kitchen into the world's number one duty-free shop with revenues of over $1.8 billion. So if you want to learn how to build a world-class organization, or you want to learn just how to take that next step, or you have some questions for me, you can see me in person. I'll be there early at 6:30, but the event starts at 7. If you have any questions about your career. But right now, we're listening to the story of David Hadley, who's the Chief Executive Officer for MediClinic Middle East. David, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you, Shane. Thanks.
So when we look at, you know, a leader's job, you know, part of it's giving the vision, direction, you know, motivation. I always hear leaders saying, oh, you know, we need to motivate these people. And then, you know, sometimes when I look at successful people, you look at Einstein, you know, he was thrown out of school. He couldn't get a job, but he just couldn't stop doing physics. I mean, the man did not need to be motivated, right? You know, and you look at some of these people, they don't need to be motivated. But on the other hand, maybe they do. So, you know, what's your take on this? Do good people need to be motivated? Should they, if you are trying too hard to motivate your people, do you have the wrong people? Or is it the leader's job to just continually push that bar ever higher? And, you know, no matter how motivated you are, let's take you to the next level.
Yeah. You know, I used to think that you're either motivated or you're not motivated. That used to be my theory, is that you're either self-motivated or you're not. And then when I was studying my MBA, you know, they have these debates in the classrooms, and somebody proved me wrong. And he said to me, you know, you can motivate people, and you probably motivate people within your own environment. You don't even know it. So the words, can you motivate people, I think you can flip it, and you can say, I think as a leader, you can definitely demotivate people. Even Albert Einstein, I think if he had somebody there telling him, no, you can't do it, you know, this is not going to work, you're speaking nonsense, this and that, eventually he'd have given up. But, you know, you can definitely demotivate people that work for you. There's no doubt about it.
Some leaders are great at that.
Yeah, brilliant at that. So I think you can demotivate people. So if you can demotivate people, I'm sure you can motivate people. So perhaps, you know, if you are setting an example of doing something in a certain way, that might motivate people. Perhaps the way that you handle them might motivate them to act in a certain way. Perhaps the way that you see things sometimes becomes the way they see things. So I think as a leader, you can definitely motivate people. And I say that because if you can demotivate people, you surely can motivate them.
If you've been demotivated by your boss, send us an SMS at 4001. Let's hear the best or the worst demotivational story. But I've had that so many times, and you just get pumped up, especially with this time of year. You take your vacation, you get so jazzed up, and, you know, yeah, New Year's and everything. You come back, and the first meeting, they just wipe you out. I mean, to the point where you just want to throw yourself out the window. You're like, I don't even feel like working here anymore. In fact, I think I'm going to quit right now. That happens sometimes. But what about ownership? And I think, you know, is it, you know, I always like to look at a rental car. You know, you never take a rental car for an oil change because you don't own it. And I find so many employees are renting their spot. You know, they're getting a job, they're renting that strategy, they're renting that identity. They don't own it, and so they don't service it properly. Do you think this is a major issue within organizations today?
I think so. I must admit, though, in Dubai, I've experienced it differently. Or should I say, within Mediclinic in Dubai, I've experienced it differently. People want to work in Dubai. It's actually quite a nice situation to work within. Is everybody's looking at their careers. Everybody's looking to perform, and everybody knows that to perform, you actually need to, you know, you need to embrace the vision of the organization. And I think there's a change around the world today, not only in Dubai. Dubai's a good example for the world in the sense that even if you're working for a boss or you're working for an employer, you're actually in business for yourself. If I take myself, as you've mentioned many times, I worked my way up in a career, so I'm actually in business for myself. If I hadn't have made sure that I learned from the mentors and studied and worked hard and tried to achieve things, then I wouldn't have earned more money. I wouldn't have got promoted. I wouldn't have moved forward in my career. So I'm always been in business for myself. If I mess up, I'm going to lose my job, and I'm probably going to lose money. So in a sense, although I'm employed, I work for myself. And I think people generally around are starting to view businesses that way today. And in Dubai specifically, I've experienced that people seem to take ownerships of their jobs. It's actually quite refreshing to see here.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, you have it's like a magnet for type A personalities all over the world.
Sure.
You know, they come here. But as a leader, what do you do, for example, at Mediclinic to give people or ensure people are taking ownership of the strategy? Because, you know, I think when you look back, you know, they used to have, or a lot of organizations still do that, so they do strategies created by the few and performed by the many. Whereas now, as we move in the 21st century, they're trying to create this flow of information where actually frontline employees have an input into the development of a strategic process aimed at developing ownership. Or, you know, how do you approach this? Which is, I think, one of the toughest things as a leader is getting someone to take ownership of a strategy. What do you do? How do you do it? How do you approach this?
Look, we have quite a few thousand people working for us, so it's quite difficult to get every single person involved in the strategy. However, when people give input, or they make suggestions, or they tell you things are not working, it's important as leaders, doesn't matter which level you are, that you listen and that you learn from those individuals, and that you actually create a culture within the organization, not just at the top, but all the way down, where you listen. Stealing. And how can this happen? How can this happen in my company where somebody's so unethical? And I turned around and I said to him, well, look, I'm not being funny, buddy, but it's the ethos of your company. That's the way you are. I'm not surprised. That's what you stand for. I mean, if you stand to be ethical, then it's important you are ethical. And then I think people will support it that way.
So did you change your golf game to a boxing match after that?
I enjoyed taking his money.
I think when you look at these ethics, integrity, it starts in it. That also stems off your self-belief, because as soon as you start cheating, then you start lying. You can't be brutally honest with yourself. You can't develop that self-belief, and you can't rise to that next level of performance. In my opinion, I don't know if you agree or disagree with that.
I think it's vital in orientation, when people join the organization, first up, that they see what you share with them, what the values are, and they make sure that they're aligned to those values. You emphasize them. They must live them. They must be their values. And, it's a relationship when people join an organization. If they don't fit those values, and those values don't fit, then it's probably not going to work out.
David Hadley is the Chief Executive Officer of Mediclinic, which is ranked in one of the top 10 largest private healthcare providers in the world. He'll be sharing more of his secrets to success in just a minute. Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're listening to the story of David Hadley, the Chief Executive Officer of Mediclinic. David, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you, Shane.
It's been pretty exciting. I mean, I can't believe you started as a filing clerk. And now, you know, you're a chief executive officer, one of the biggest groups out here, 3,000 staff under your watch. That's a lot of responsibility. I mean, does that must stress you out sometimes?
I never thought about it like that until now.
3,000 staff, and you know, if you just have a minimum of 4 people per family, that's actually like 12,000 people are depending on you. So, you know, don't mess up.
Yeah, I better go back to work after this. Yeah.
If you weren't stressed before, you're stressed now. No. We had a question here about people asking about what are quick kickbacks in hospitals. I think, you know, if I could just tackle that one, I think a kick, will you correct me if I'm wrong, I think a kickback is where, for example, if I'm selling you a bunch of x-ray equipment and I say, buy my equipment and I'll give you 10% back under the table cash.
Yeah, or even worse, what happens is a doctor will send you for an x-ray and get paid for sending you for that x-ray.
He'll get paid for sending
X-ray. It's in most countries it's deemed to be unethical.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I think everywhere it pretty much is. So you basically are leading through. What's the toughest thing about leading a team of 3,000?
I think there's many challenges in leading people. It's I mean, the most difficult task I think of a business is the people side of it. Is understanding the, I mean, especially here in the Middle East where we have so many different cultures, we've got over 50 different nationalities working for us. Everybody has a different understanding of the way you do things. So I think one of the challenges here in managing people is situational leadership, is managing people the way they want to be managed. And that could be different for different cultures, for different sexes, for et cetera. So I find that's quite challenging in terms of managing the people.
There's always a point in our show where we have to find out your secrets, you know, what are your secrets to success. And I think we're at that moment right now.
ION Careers now reveals the secrets to success.
So, David, what is your secret to success?
Well, I actually have, I don't know if it's a secret to success, but I have a life motto. And I think this has been my secret to success. And it's a saying that it goes, have fun. And I'll elaborate on it just now, but it's have fun, be yourself, and just do it.
ION Careers, in association with LeMoon.com. Refresh your career with jobs, courses, and events.
So what's that? Have fun. I got that part. I got that part right. I think that's pretty easy. But does that make you successful? What are the other two parts? I think that you
be yourself and just do it.
And just do it. So you're not. So you wear Nikes then?
I'm still going to sue them for using my motto.
You know who? I think it was Andrew Carnegie. One of his motto was inspiration to action, which is another way of saying just do it. You know, get off your laurels and get moving. And I had Jeffrey Singer on here, who's the CEO of the DIFC Authority. Yeah. And he said, you know, a moving car is easier to steer than a parked one, and just get things moving. And Steve Smith was just on here, and he was saying, you know, like, get moving, just start getting things going. Yeah. Is that it? You think it's better to start moving even if you're going in the wrong direction because it's easier to turn?
I find the just do it side of my motto, should I say, there's three components to it, but the just do it side for me is most people talk about especially this time of the year, they talk about their new, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to start studying a new language.
I did that.
I'm going to do all sorts of things, but they don't do it. And I'll never forget two of my colleagues and friends that I worked with. When we came to Dubai, we were busy building the city hospital. And, you know, I said to them, you know, you guys, you need to study. You need to get on with it. You need to, you know, you need to really start studying. And they turned around. They've known me for a while. And they said, but David, you've been talking about doing your MBA for years. When are you going to do it? And I said, yeah, you know, I'll do it. But you guys need to get going. You know, you need to do it. And they said, well, look, we're busy with this hospital. Let's wait till the hospital's open and then we'll start studying. I said, just do it. And they said, what about you? Come on, just do it. And then I realized I'm actually not even living my own motto. So I did it. I went and I did it.
Where did you do your MBA?
Through University of Liverpool. Online, yeah.
And was it worth it?
Absolutely. It was really worth it. Yeah.
What was the big, you know, the big takeaway for doing the MBA? Because there's people out there right now who are sitting on the fence and saying, should I do my MBA? Should I not do it?
Just do it.
Just do it.
No, I think for me, I was already in a senior position. I wasn't the CEO. It was before I became the CEO. But for me, the MBA...
So this was the clincher. This is how you became CEO.
I'm not sure, but the timing was very serendipitous, if I can say that. But if I look at it, it definitely gave me more confidence in the experience that I had. Let's put it that way. And it applied a lot of the theory to what I'd learned.
I just hit the microphone by mistake when you said that, because that's exactly what I was going to say, is okay. That, you know, I think the big thing between the people who have huge success and don't is confidence is one of the biggest things. And the NBA can be a huge confidence
sure.
builder.
Yeah.
So you became CEO right after you got your MBA.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I think everyone's going to go out and get it done. I have a quick theory I just wanted to bounce off you, because one of my predictions, and this is completely pedestrian because I'm not involved in healthcare very much, but I've seen this, you know, there's this big drive of people, everybody, his brother and his dog, are investing in healthcare, and they're like, oh, we got to have a healthcare, we're going to have a hospital, we're going to have these clinics, right? And, you know, and like, how many of these people are actually qualified, you know, unlike you, where you've worked your way up, how many of these people are actually qualified to run a hospital? And when you look at it, it's not such an easy, you know, you just don't build a cement building and throw some doctors in there and all of a sudden you're going to have a profitable hospital. So what my prediction is that you're going to see this big, you know, rush of hospitals opening, and then a bunch of them are going to go out of business because they're not going to be run properly. They're not going to be profitable. They're going to lose massive amounts of money. And that's what I see happening. And there's very few, like, I think your organization, I think you have InterHealth Canada, which does a bang up job as well. You have Cleveland Clinic. You have a couple of, you know, dyed in the wool hardcore hospital operators that have been doing it for decades and decades, and they're going to do it for decades and decades more. You also have these new guys coming up who are getting in over their head, I think. And what do you think about that?
I think there is a few coming in like that, which is unfortunate. It's not easy to just go from being, I don't know, running sweet shops, all of a sudden you're running healthcare organizations. They're completely different. And I hope that they are successful and that they bring the right people in to run these organizations, because healthcare as a whole has a reputation. It's not just the individual operators. If you look at the cruiser line industry, the Costa Concordia that crashed, all of a sudden people all over the world started cancelling their boat cruises because of one guy pranging a boat. So it's quite important that the healthcare organizations that do open in Dubai and that do get going do it properly, because otherwise it's going to tarnish the reputation of healthcare. So I hope that they do it well, but without a doubt, everybody's trying to get into healthcare. It's not easy, and I'm obviously going to say this being in the industry, but it is different to, say, running a hotel. We can't run a hotel. There's no ways I would know how to run a hotel. I can't run a motor dealership. I have no clue. So it's stick to your knitting and you know, stick to what you can and what you can do, and get the right people in who can do it.
Yeah, I think the 24-hour room service will get you. You know,
yeah.
So what do you have, any advice for a person for those filing clerks out there who want to be CEO?
Yeah, I think the second component of my saying is be yourself. And I'll never forget, I was a filing clerk and I applied for, I reckon, I don't know, 10 different jobs. And I kept on being told I was inexperienced, I was too young, I didn't have the right qualifications, you're not ready. And eventually I got a promotion into an HR clerk. And then I was over the moon that I got this promotion. And I was working with a lady in my office, who I was now leaving that office and going to a different hospital. And she actually said to me, you know, David, she wrote me a little card, and I wish I'd kept it, but I remember it. And she said, David, from now onwards, you're going to get many promotions over many years. And she says, please don't change. She said, I want you to remember this forever, is be yourself. Don't ever change. Don't try and be somebody you're not. And the more I think of that saying, the more it is applied to me and my success, I think. And the more I see people who fail, if I take myself, I thought I could be an accountant. There's no ways I can be an accountant. I mean, I'm outgoing, I'm extroverted, et cetera, et cetera. So it's be yourself. Don't try and be somebody you're not, and understand who you are and what you can become. And then I think you will be successful.
Well, David, thank you so much for coming out. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I wish we had another hour to go and explore. There's so much stuff to talk about, but I want to thank you so much for taking time to come and share your insights to us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
That was the story of David Hadley, the Chief Executive Officer of MediClinic Middle East, leading a team of 3,000 here in the region, and globally they're ranked in the top 10. So one of the top private healthcare providers in the world. It's pretty amazing. I wanted to thank all of you for listening to Ion Careers. We have a live event on January 14th at 7 p.m. It's absolutely free, and it's Colm McLaughlin, who's the executive vice chairman of Dubai Duty Free. Hear the story of three men who stepped off a plane in 1983 and turned an old used kitchen into one of the world's greatest duty-free shops. In fact, it is the greatest duty-free shop in the world, with revenues of $1.8 billion. He has a greater revenue than Harrods and Sheffield's. It's really not just one of the top duty-free shops. It's actually one of the top retail operations in the entire world. I think they sell over 70 million pieces of merchandise every year. It's crazy. In fact, people just fly through Dubai apparently to go to this duty-free shop. But he's going to be talking about how to build a world-class organization, how to manage your career, and that's all free on Tuesday, January 14th at 7 p.m. in the Canadian University of Dubai. And also be there talking about how to negotiate your salary. So there's all kinds of excitement there. So hopefully you can join us on Tuesday, January 14th. That's it for this episode of Ion Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, wishing you good luck in chasing your dreams, and I'll talk to you soon.